You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. So thanks to a technical glitch, we just found out that a whole bunch of you didn't get the news that the early bird pricing for the Producers Perspective Pro Super Conference ended last week. Yep, it was supposed to be last week. But because of the technical screw-up, we have extended the early bird pricing. You can save up to $200 if you register for the Super Conference by this Sunday, July 23rd, but that's it. After that, price goes up. Go to theproducersperspective.com/conference, register today, and we'll see you in November.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
My name is Ken Davenport. This is the Producers Perspective Podcast. We have a very special guest today, so thanks for joining us. He has been an actor, director, producer on both sides of this country. He is Mr. Don Scardino. Welcome, Don.
Hey, Ken. Good to be here.
So Don is an actor. He's been in a ton of Broadway shows. One of his most notable appearances was as Jesus, the original company of Godspell. For how many performances did you do this show?
Over a thousand performances.
He went on to direct on Broadway, including Few Good Men and Lennon, which he conceived and wrote as well. Went on to direct a ton of television, including a bunch of shows you've never heard of, like Law & Order. How many episodes of Law & Order, Don?
Dozens and dozens, from season 1 to season 17 only.
Also directed for 30 Rock, Two Broke Girls, and so many others. So, Don, obviously you got started in the theater. When did you get bit by the bug? It was the first time.
I was bitten and infected forever. When I was 5 years old, my babysitter was at the High School of Performing Arts, and she was cast in a production of Kismet, the Paper Mill Playhouse. So my parents took me and my brother, and we went. We sat in the second row. And when the princesses of Abad Boo, I think that was what they're called in Kismet, came dancing out, there's my babysitter, Judy, on the stage, all made up and looking great. She winked at me. And I made this connection, like, wait a minute. Babysitters do this. People you know do this. And so I was transfixed, watching Judy dance around. And then afterwards, we went backstage, and Evelyn Hodge, the beggar, the star of the show, was pulling his beard off, and sets were being pushed aside, and the ghost light was being put out. That was it. I was done. I said, that's it. 5 years old.
Wow. So what was the first time on stage for you after five? Five and a half? Were you like...
Close. I mean, I hocked my parents mercilessly. They were musicians, so they were both inclined to let me be an actor, but also, you know, not so inclined because they were in the business in a way. But I started acting, I think around age 12. I started doing children's theater downtown, off Broadway type stuff, and then got my equity card in the production of Critics' Choice with Hans Conried, who was the old Uncle Tanous on the Danny Thomas show, and Ethel Chute, who was Jack Benny's first sidekick on radio. And I was, again, just bitten really hard. I came back with an equity card. I went to the audition, which was an equity audition. They said, are you equity? I said, sure. And they said, well, you know, you have to sign in. And I said, oh, my mom has that, and she's not with me. So I went and read, got the part, ran down to equity, all of 13 years old.
13?
Yeah. I used to knock on doors in this very building. I got a list of equity franchised agents from Actors Equity Association. I knocked on doors in this very building. Oh, my name is Don Scardino. Here's my picture. You know, that I had my brother's friend take totally fictitious resume on the back. And, you know, today I would have been killed quickly. But, you know, ultimately landed a manager on West 45th Street, a woman named Muriel Cole. Carl. I had a bunch of kid actors, and just started working.
You were knocking on doors as a kid.
I was.
What made you think you had the confidence to pull this off?
I have no idea. I mean, I did. I used to sing on the steps of my house for the neighbors, and they used to like it. Nobody threw anything. They waited till I was finished with the song, you know, and they would applaud. And I thought, well, I must be good. And I just did that. Even then, I just knew this was the life for me. And I kept at it. And I think, I'm going to say 15. So that's like two, three years in, I got the guiding light, 15 or 16, guiding light 16. And I was on TV every day of the week, live, black and white, 15 minutes long on CBS. And I was making more money than my dad, who was a jazz musician.
And did you know that at the time? Or you were like, huh?
Well, he finally told me, you know, I hit a peak one day.
Now, a lot of childhood performers either don't go on to success later in life in the business as an actor. You seem to make that transition okay. Why do you think that was?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, I always looked younger. You can tell the folks at home that even though I'm 90, I look like a young 68. And, you know, so I was playing all these juveniles, really. And then these guys started coming to town out of college. You know, it was Kevin Kline, Bill Hurt. These guys, they became friends, but they were all like zooming past me and playing young dads. And, you know, I'm still playing, you know, can I have the keys to the car? I was still stuck in this juvenile thing. So that was number one. I thought, maybe this is not exactly the right fit. And then played Jesus and Godspell for all that time. And that kind of was the greatest experience I've ever had, but also kind of ruined me because it's like, well, what's going to be better than this? Even Hamlet doesn't sing. You know, Hamlet doesn't get into a soft shoe and orange sneakers. So I thought, well, what's going to, and so I was kind of becoming disaffected, and I did a play called How I Got That Story by Amelie Gray for Second Stage at the West Side Arc, and it was a big hit. Me and Bob Gunton, two actors, played the entire war of Vietnam. Great play. And a great reviews, and about 2 days after we opened, with all these wonderful personal reviews for both of us, I found myself, you know, do you have an up in a ballad to go sing for, you know, I don't know, over here or something. You know, I thought, wait, don't you ever get a leg up? So that was step two in my business. And then finally, the guy who wrote How I Got That Story suggested that I direct at the, talk about off-Broadway, at the Manitoba Theater Center, you know, north of North Dakota. It's way, way up there. And so I went and I thought, sure, I was so flattered to be asked. So I just thought, well, I'll just, you know, do Remount the New York Show. And I got up there, it was a thrust stage. And the New York Show was a proscenium stage. I realized, oh, I have to completely restage this. I have to come up with my own ideas. And I had the best time. And I went from being juvenile to being dead. And it was so nice. It felt so good. And so I came back to town, and Steve, who ran the thing called the Manhattan Punchline, which was on Theater Row, he asked me to direct it to Paul Foster. He heard I'd been directing, and then Carol Rothman, who knew I'd been directing, so she had directed originally How I Got the Story. She asked me to direct Kathy and Jimmy and Mo Gaffney, who wanted to take their comedy act onto the theater format. So I did that. And next thing you know, I was off.
So I obviously want to talk a lot about this continued transition of yours as a director, but the Godspell fans out there will kill me if I don't, will crucify me, if I don't back up a little bit and talk about that experience and how could you get better than this. What was it like being a part of that show? Did you have any idea when you were doing it that it would become a show that is still so widely performed and produced today?
Some. In that I joined the show. The show had been done at Carnegie Tech, Carnegie Mellon, and then it came into town with the folk songs that they done at Carnegie. You probably know all this. I don't know if the folks at home do. And then went to the Tula Mama, and basically the kids from school came and did the show. The fellow who played Jesus was a fellow named Andy Rohrer. He didn't because he had a little minor pot in Pittsburgh, so he had to stay
still
behind.
Still regretting this
yeah.
day.
So he finally did come into the New York show. But anyway, so the show was, I got to see the show and think, you know, when then Schwartz came in, when they moved it to the Cherry Lane, Schwartz wrote the score, kept by myself in the original. And so I got to see it in its original form with the new songs and be blown away by it. This is just the most amazing. Cut to, I'm working in Canada on a movie. I'm friends with Victor Garber, who's in the Toronto production of Godspell. And he said, I just got the movie and I can't leave these kids in the lurch. Literally, he had just opened the show like 2 weeks earlier at the Royal Alex in Toronto. That company was Marty Short, Eugene Levy, Andrea Martin, Paul Schaefer on the keyboard. I mean, it was an amazing group of people. And he said, you're the guy. You're. So I'm told, never actually asked Stephen this, but I'm told that Schwartz had wanted me to be Pippin. Auditioned and got to the very last. But Fosse wanted Rubinstein. I was offered the original understudy of Pippin, and I didn't want to take it. So I said, no. That was good, because Godspell came up very shortly thereafter up in Toronto, and they said, Schwartz said, hire him. I love him. Hire him. So I get to go up to Toronto, replace Victor. I'm there for a couple of months, and they say, we need a Jesus in New York, coming to New York. And I played in New York for several years, then left it, did other things, and then was brought back in to open Broadway.
It's such an amazing story of like how different your life could have been had you gotten Pippin. You know, like, obviously, John, not the big
wonderful
star,
things, of course.
Wonderful things, but who knows
yes.
what might have happened.
No,
it's and
true.
It's just a great reminder for everyone out there that sometimes everything really does happen for a reason, and when you're miserable about not getting something, it can lead to something better.
It truly does. I mean, because, I went home disappointed that I didn't get Pippin, but I didn't want second place, and I was really bummed. But look what it got me. And it got me this incredible experience. So I knew what it was. Did I know it was going to be a phenomenon? You know, we would come out, coming out on stage in Godspell, first of all, there were movie stars in the audience and all these people there, but it was like you were in a spaceship and took off and took everybody with you. It was like this otherworldly experience. I can't really explain it, although those who've been a part of Godspell understand what that feeling is like in the house. But on stage, it was, the people were transported. I mean, it almost didn't matter if we were tired, end of, say, a four-show weekend. You go out and the people were like, we're at Godspell. And they're all lit up. And the audience would take you, and it never ever remember not lifting off in that magical way.
Well, let's get back to the directing. Now, your first Broadway directing gig was this little play called A Few Good Men. Is that right?
Yeah. What happened to that writer? I don't know.
He once said to me, like, we did a reading of A Few Good Men, and Aaron actually said to me, like, This writer's going someplace. This guy's got some talent, but I need to give him a few notes.
Well, we talked about causality a minute ago, which is like how you get to things. And, I was directing because I had now become a director, and I was directing anywhere they'd ask or let me. And so I was directing Pump Boys and Dinettes and the Middle Ages at the Sharon Playhouse in Connecticut, almost as far as the Manitoba Theater. And so I'm up there, and my stage manager was a guy named David Lansky, later went on. General manager of the ABT, but at that point he was a schlepper like the rest. And he said, hey, I got this guy talking to me. Thinks he wants to be a writer. He thought he wanted to be an actor. Now he wants to be a writer. He sells, lemonade at the Broadway Theater. He's got this play and he's a big fan of yours. I saw Godspell, I don't know how many times. And now here I was working with you, and would you please read this? Of course. He gives me a play by Aaron Sorkin called Removing All Doubt. A bunch of kids in college with this very Aaron-like figure who's kind of the trips master of this group of kids. And the dialogue is sensational. It's supposed to be a mystery, and you get to the end of the play, there's no mystery. But I said to him, look, you need to have this read. You need to hear it, because it doesn't work, but you need to hear how to fix it. And the way to do that is, okay. So we get actors together, we do a reading, give them some notes, the reading goes very well. I say, good luck, kid. I leave. A year later, he said, Mr. Scardino, remember me, Aaron Sorkin? Of course, Aaron, how are you? I got another play, and this one has a producer attached to it. Proceeds to tell me that he handed the script to a producer named David Brown, and who said, I'm not producing plays, I produce movies. And Aaron said, well, I want to do it as a play. Talk about Stones. So he partnered with Robert Whitehead. And Aaron dragged me in to meet Robert Whitehead and David Brown. Says, this is the guy I want to direct the play. And they're like, they said, well, how would you do it? What kind of set do you envision? I said, no set. And they went, what? I said, no set. Like a battleship. It's a deck of a battleship. Lights, sound, maybe the fence line across the back. And that's it. And Whitehead said, I like this young man. Just like that. And that was it. I got the job.
It's amazing because again, there's something I want to make sure we go back and then focus on, brushed over so quickly, but a guy you've never heard of who can recommend it from a statement, and you're working now, I mean, you're doing stuff,
sure.
You've got a career, said, will you read my cousin's play? And you said yes, huh? And you did it, and then you did a reading, which is, I think, so important to just do things at times, to just be open to these, because you never know when the guy calling you up is going to be Aaron Sorkin.
You never know. And my mother raised me to always be nice. What did I have to lose? Nothing. I like David Lansky. He was a really good stage manager. And I figured if he was a nice guy, his cousin must be a nice guy. And, and it's another thing, too, which is that, yes, it was a role of the dice, but, I read the play and I thought, this kid writes dialogue. I mean, this dialogue is snappy and smart. And, I said to him, I can tell you're an actor because this is really playable. So, yeah, be nice.
And what, just tell me in this, sentence. I'll ask you my you're at a bar in Omaha question, which is you saddle up at a bar in Omaha and you're sitting next to someone that's never seen a play before in their life. They ask you what you do. You say, I direct plays. And they go, what's
that?
What the heck is that? What do you do? What does it do?
What does a director do?
Yeah.
Well, director does a lot of things. One of the things a director does is he makes the space comfortable for everyone working on that production to do their best work. So to me, the director is like a a synthesis in a way, like the middle, the cynosure of some spinning wheel that is this play, this production. The director's job is to take and support all the artists and inspire them, lead them, guide them, argue with them if necessary, always from a positive play. Good choice. That's a great choice. Hold on to that, because this is the second week. Let's do that in this other one. Find our way. So that what you then do, you're basically, you're like the conductor of a great orchestra. You're a focuser. Take all these people who play incredibly, but on their own don't make up the orchestra. You need the conductor to make that symphony happen. So that's what a director does. He's like a conductor, pulls all those things together and feeds them back out. Focuses them through an idea or a vision, something that makes it communicate. To me, the theater is the act of communicating, transmission. The actors get the playwright's text in their bodies, in their souls, in their spirit, and the force of their playing transmits it to every single member who lands there. And it can't be removed by a surgeon. It stays there forever. And my brother once said to me when I was really hocked about doing yet another performance in Clownsville, and he said, "You don't understand. You've done now 737 performances, and for you it's like going to work again." He said, "But there's a person out there, and probably all of the people out there, who have waited and waited and waited to come see Godspell. This is the only time they're going to see Godspell. They're going to go home, and that Godspell is going to be in their mind and heart forever, like Kismet was in mine. And it will always burn very brightly, and that's the great privilege you have to give the person that." And so that's what the director, and to me, it always has to be from a place of love.
And when you do theater, you talk about it. You obviously went into that meeting. You had a very clear visual image of what that play was going to be. No set, like a battleship.
Right.
Is that how all of you, when you ever direct plays, there's a strong visual that you come up with first? Is it
usually
a process?
Yeah, usually it's something, as soon as I read, whether it's a TV script, movie script, play script, there are sort of visual things starts happening in my imagination. If I can see it, and it's not even something I'm doing necessarily, but it says I read, it takes a kind of life. And if I can see it, then I have a sense about the world of it. I find that if I'm lost a lot, and sometimes, you know, it doesn't always, sometimes the more difficult work doesn't always easily open up to you because it's deep. It may take a couple of readings, but in one or two readings it'll come along. Yeah, so I guess visually is what happens first.
So you brought up television, so let's talk about this a little bit because you've done what probably every single person working in the theater dreams about doing, which is somehow managed to take your career, sort of successful career in theater, and translate it to Hollywood. How did that come about? Where did that offer come from, and what made you think you could actually do it?
Well, a couple of things. One, when I was a kid actor, I did The Guiding Light was live, and it was four cameras. And because I was the kid, I got sort of easy access to the control room. I could stand on the floor next to the cameraman. I could ask questions, and they were interested in, you know, sharing their knowledge. So I was fascinated by what the director was doing. I was fascinated by what the cameraman was doing. I never planned not to be an actor, but I was fascinated by that. So I asked a lot of questions. So I had that sort of foundation. When I was directing theater, a woman that I had acted with on The Guiding Light when I was 6 years old, played my mother, was now the head writer of a show called Another World. And she said, "I've written this part for you." And I said, "Oh, I'm not acting anymore. I'm directing the theater." She said, "I know, but I really want to do this part." I said, I'm not. She said, "Well, we'll give you this much." And I said, "No, I'm really." I said, "Well, how about we double that money?" Finally, I said, "Look, okay, this is all great, but let me direct one. You know, tell the producers I want to direct one and I'll sign up for you." So I did. And that was the deal I made. 6 months in, the producers changed. Producer says, "I'm firing you because you're too old to play opposite that girl you're playing. I saw you in Godspell. I know how old you really are." I said, "Okay, but I have this deal to direct." And he said, "It's pay or play, babe. You know, I can pay you off." Okay. I slink out of the office. The next day, I get nominated for an Emmy, daytime Emmy, in the under 24 category. And I was about 30 something. So he calls me back in his office. I go, "Oh, sure. Now I've got the Emmy. You want me to stay on?" He said, no, that's not it. You're still fired. But I was thinking about what you said about having a directing deal, and okay, I want to build my own stable of directors. So, long story short, 6 weeks later, I'm directing Another World. He puts me on a contract for 2 years. So, I made a transition. Now, this is important for theater directors. Multicam, sitcom, is multicam, meaning four cameras shoot it at once in a proscenium-like way. Same thing with sitcoms. You have an audience, and you have a proscenium-based presentational in a three-walled set, and same with soap operas. And so, it's an easy transition for a theater director to make. Understand how the cameras work because you're basically staging it in the same way we stage theater, diagonals and triangles and across the front and all the rest. So those things, the Anschlager diagonal, they all work for you. And then once you get the camera set down, that's great. So, again, the chain of causality rears its ugly head. Victor Garber, my pal, and Blair Brown, my other pal, are doing a new show in L.A. called The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd for NBC. And I got a call from Blair, who I'd acted with in the park. And she said, my producer hates all the directors out here. We've given your name. And you fly out here on your own nickel and meet him. So I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. Come out there. Never directed film. I go out there. Jay Tarsus is his name. And he said, and I give him my little reel of soap opera stuff, action scenes from soap opera. He said, what's that? I said, what's my soap opera? He said, I don't like it. He said, here, just read this. Tell me if you think it's funny. Sit over there. And I go sit in the corner of his office and I read the script. He said, so what do you think? Yeah, it's funny. I like it. All right, you can direct it. I went, what? He said, you can direct it. I mean, I may be crazy, but Blair and Victor both say you're smart. So, okay. Not only did direct it, but then he gave me two more. And then he said, the show's moving to New York. I live in L.A. I'm about to go back and forth, so you're going to be the supervising producer in New York. I said, Jay, I've never produced anything. He said, that's all right. You know, it's not that hard. Believe me. A lot of people in this town produce. You're going to be the supervisor. So that's how that all came about. The unit production manager of that show goes off to start a new show for NBC, which is like run-and-gun cop show. He says, you've got to come and do one. I said, okay, sure. It's an hour long. He said, but we're like guerrilla TV. We're out there with handheld cameras. We're going to sell it. That was Law and Order. So you see, it really is about your relationship. Very important that, you know, the group you come out of school with, the group you do a show with, you know, that you maintain these relationships.
It's true. You obviously have great skill and talent because you wouldn't have been acting alongside people like Victor Garber, etc.
Sure.
But the relationships trumped it all. You were getting jobs not because someone was saying, oh, show, tell me about your diagonal, tell me about all this right. stuff. It was like someone said you were great, so we're just going to hire you.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. And again, you know, the old rubric, be nice, comes back. But the truth of the matter is, because I started acting, it was my playground. It was my backyard. It was growing up. It was my college. I had the best time. And I went in with all the sort of naivete, but also wonder and also joy of being a child. So I've never lost that. I mean, thank you. You know, and it's in a way, I think these are all people that I work with that recommend me to other people. Because I go in and always have fun and have a good time, That's more important than almost anything, you know, because you could say, this guy may direct a little better than that guy, but you'll have more fun with this guy. It's very fortunate.
So let's talk a little bit about the two mediums that you're both working in now, theater and sitcoms. What's something that the theater world could learn from the television world? Is it the development, the production? What, if you were coming back and could take one thing from Hollywood to how we do it here, what would it be?
I would say that One of the things about the sitcom world that has in common with the theater world is they're in front of a live audience. And it doesn't matter really what it finally looks like on television so much as that it plays in front of the audience. And it is the process of working on a sitcom. You have 5 days to put a show up. And you're constantly working it. Then the audience comes in. And if they don't laugh at a certain joke, again, they're comedies, so you know, it's only applicable in comedy, but they don't have a certain joke. Those writers are out there sweating to come up with new jokes because it's bombing. And I think that is one of the things. I think Broadway has to remember to serve its audience. I sat in the audience of a play, you know, and Broadway's been everything. You know, the Fabulous Invalid that we know as Broadway, that has everything from historically from Boulevard comedies to cheesy musicals to great things like Hamilton and all the rest of it. And star-driven packages and all those things. When it knows its audience and works for its audience, that's when it's the most successful. It doesn't matter really whether it's great art or not. Great art to boot, like something like Hamilton, then bravo all the way, you know. But I think that's important. Television being a mass medium in a way. And I think that is sort of what's happening on Broadway in a way. You find that, you know, you need brand names. You need things that the audience is going to want to see. And those things, hopefully, God willing, feed the other shows that may not have the brand, but are worthy of catching their audience. So I would say that, you know, what the television does not do well is serve a master known as advertising. And so it frequently sells out, you know, sells its own child short to get the advertising dollar. Broadway never did that. It's never succumbed to that. Just because it is so expensive, it's tempting to do. But truthfully, it's really, where is the audience coming from? Who are they?
What about the writer? What separates a writer like Aaron Sorkin, who obviously was such an incredible playwright and then translated his art to the small screen very successfully, what advice would you give to playwrights that want to write for television, or what do they need to be able to write on both?
Well, you know, it's funny that you talk to William Goldman, who describes himself as a failed playwright, and Aaron describes himself as a playwright, even though it's been a while since he's done a play. So there is this thing that says the real work, you know, I'm actually a playwright, you know, this is just direct. And it's true that being an audience medium and being something that has to appeal to the lowest common denominator, so the advertising dollars come in, that you do write some direct. But if Shakespeare were alive today, would he be writing for two broke girls? You know, the only, you know, game in town was The Globe, you know, or something like it. So, you know, I think we do our artists a disservice by saying, well, you know, you write for television or you write for theater. So the truth of the matter is, in television, what you need to have is a common touch. You need to have, you know, an idea that will appeal to you, even if it's packaged in a very artful way. A show like Atlanta, which is kind of like off-Broadway television. But the stories are very real, and they're about real people, and they're also very funny. Because Donald Glover is very funny, but Donald Glover got his start writing on 30 Rock for television. So, you know, can't discount it. You can't say it's not nearly as good as a play. It happens to maybe even touch the emotional pulse of the country even quicker than some playwriting these days. So I would say, A, don't limit yourself by thinking you are one thing or another, and, you know, write stories that won't appeal.
Do you think a writer's room could ever exist for a Broadway show?
Do not.
Why?
Well, because, first of all, you need the writer's room because you're producing anywhere from 10 to 22 episodes in a season. And that is a Pac-Man monster that goes faster and faster as the season goes on. Because not only, once the season gets going, not only are you doing the show that's in production, but you've got three or four in post-production, various stages that need to be attended to. And you've got three or four that are in the writing stage that need to be attended to. And it is like the plate spinner on the inside. It's just, all of this is going on at once. It's a circus. The theater, fortunately, is not like that. You know, you're working on one piece, and you have however long it takes you to craft that play, and then however long you might work with the director for that play who's in rehearsal, and you have 4 weeks, you might go out of town, all that stuff. So you don't have the need that, because television is a hungry beast that eats its young and is a bit of a sausage factory. You don't have that needing that assembly, which is really what a writer's room is. Now, the other thing that I think that helps it in television is because if it's a comedy, anything from Show of Shows, you know, on to Two Broke Girls or anything else, that you need jokes. And, you know, one person can only be so funny so many hours of the day. So you have this group of people that all throw in jokes, and that's how you ensure comedy will be its sort of best you can be. But I don't think so. And I think also playwriting, you know, well, I just said, you know, writing is writing no matter where you're doing it. That is true if you are the sole writer. On television and drama, it's frequently you are the sole. You might have one or two people massaging. You might have an executive producer who's a writer at weekend. But the drama is usually worth one person's script. And I think there's something about having a voice. It's what Aaron has been able to do in television, actually. But Aaron isn't crazy because he insists on writing every single line of the show. You know, he's a tired guy.
That's why we haven't seen him on Broadway anymore.
True, he has no time. But, you know, it is... I remember one day he said, I don't know what I'm going to write this week on the West Wing. I think I'm going to write about the president driving to work because that's all I do. I drive to work, I drive home. I have no other life. I have nothing else. I'm in the writer's room. So, but it's a grind.
What about acting for film and television versus acting for the stage?
It's different. What I tell actors who have worked on theater and not gone on television or into the cinema yet is that, you know, they'll invariably, they've been working for the second balcony. They're going to be a little long. Eyebrow's going to go way up, and the body's going to be engaged in a way, and the voice is going to come up. And, you know, camera is like right in front of them. So what I tell them was, imagine as if your head was rolled out onto the stage, and it's the size of the proscenium, and your chin touches the deck, and your head scrapes the curtain at the top. That's how big your head is. So how much work do you think you need to do to get this point across? All you have to do is think it, and the audience is going to know. Because, you know, a close-up. And particularly now that we've got, you know, 65-inch screens at home, it's really large. So it's a great place to practice your underplaying.
Fast forward 20 years from now, which medium do you think is more successful, the theater, Broadway, or television?
Depending on how you define success, I mean, the truth of the matter is that theater still, to this day, is the only where you sit in a group of people and have this common experience. Only be done live. Whether that theater is on Broadway or in somebody's backyard, there are a group of people on stage and a group of people sitting, watching, and those two groups of people are having experience together. And it's that live transmission I talked about earlier. That's what makes it so resonant in the soul area. The Television can't do it. Movies can't do it. You can have a communal experience in the movies, so you can have a group feel by sitting in the movies and experiencing together, but those actors aren't there. So you're not having that transmission that becomes the Godspell spaceship that I spoke about. So I think, in a way, in terms of that, that will never change. And it can never be taken away. You could say that, you know, the rubber becomes too expensive, or, you know, bomb hits Times Square or whatever. But this kind of storytelling will always exist. The other will continue to go through its technological changes. The closest thing that may happen is that you'll go see a hologram of a play presented where you will sit in your living room and your friends can sit around in a semicircle or in 360 degrees. And in the middle is a hologram of a play. And that will be maybe close to that experience that we talked about. But again, not in the same space.
You've achieved a lot of success in a lot of different areas throughout your life and career. Any little tips, life hacks? Do you do yoga? Do you meditate? Have a fancy to-do list that you could share with us that keeps you on track with as busy, with as many plates that you have to spin?
I have a clown suit at home. It's a big S on it.
And actually,
I am a meditator, which is not to say everyone should meditate, but I am a meditator. I've been a meditator for 40 years.
40?
Yeah, and it helps with perspective. I'm 42, by the way.
Right after this, Matt, you went and started meditating
that's right.
on how to make a successful career in the arts.
You know, I do think it's important. You know, acting to me is like pop sociology in a way. You study the human condition and you portray it. So you need to, it's almost like you need to be a witness to history. You need to be very plugged into what's going on and what people are feeling. You need to be an empath. You need to be attuned to the current time that's happening now in your world, but you need to stay at least a beat behind it, because you need to be able to portray that. In order to portray that or present it, you need to have a point of view. And at a point of view, you can't be in the middle of your own mishigas, as they say in Italian. So you need to work on yourself to the degree that you can sort of build that witness part of you. Learn to meditate, learn to do yoga, it's good. Learn to step back and be the witnesser rather than the experiencer. You need to be the experiencer too, so you can actually go on stage and experience it, but you need to be able to portray the human condition, and that takes...
So my last question, which is my James Lipton-like genie question, we call it. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to visit you and says, "Don, I saw you in Godspell, you were amazing. I want to thank you for those 1,000+ performances and all the other contributions you made to the theater. We're better off because of you. And I'm going to grant you one wish. What's the one thing about Broadway drives you nuts? You're such a nice guy. What makes you angry, upset, makes you flip a table over, ask this genie to wish away?"
Prices. You know, how can we make the theater available to everyone and affordable? And that's why anytime someone tries to do it, it's always so worthy. You know, when I was a kid, I was going to the High School of Performing Arts over there on 46th Street, and I went to see Kirk Douglas in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for $2.50. And $2.50 was probably my weekly allowance. But, and even back then, it wasn't that much. So, you know, and standing room and all that stuff that we used to get. Is it still standing room?
Yes.
They do. I didn't know.
Sometimes they sell out. And they're a lot more than 250.
They're the 250. But, so that's, you know, that's like anything. That's a big societal problem. But it's so important to find a way to get theater into people's hearts and lives without, you know, mortgaging your house to buy the ticket.
How much were Godspell tickets, do you remember?
I don't. They were probably $20. You know, they're probably a little more moved to Broadway, but yeah.
Well, it's a good wish to have for sure. Thank you so much for everything you've done for the theater and everything you've done television as well. Hey. Thanks to all of you for listening. We will see you next time. Don't forget to subscribe.
Don't forget, you have one more week, and just one more week until Sunday, July 23rd, to register for the Super Conference and save a couple $100. It's going to be a great time. Can't wait to see you there. Register today.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.